And good morning, everybody, and welcome to WJTN and the Times of Your Life. I'm Andrew Hill.
I'm Russ Dietrich.
And Russ, it's great to be back in the studio again. It's we've had so many months off away from each other with the COVID-19 pandemic. I know people are just sick and tired of hearing pandemic, and I know there's one guy who during the whole thing was trying to stay positive and be a voice for small businesses and for his customers and for his business, and that's Chad Eklof, and we invited him to join us here today.
Well, it's going to be a great program.
It is. And Chad, with that, welcome to the Times of Your Life. I was telling you off the air, there are so many different directions we can go with you, but first and foremost, I think for our listeners, probably the best way to introduce you is the fact that, yeah, it's Eklof's Bakery.
Yeah.
So, Chad, tell us from the very beginning, what is your earliest memory when it comes to Eklof's Bakery?
Earliest memory. Well, first off, good morning to both of you and everybody listening. The earliest memory that I have of the bakery would have to be when I was in there as a kid. And, you know, in lieu of getting a babysitter, the babysitter was the flour bags. And so we would go in there, both my brother and I, when we were younger, and we would climb on the flour bags like it was a jungle gym or something. And we had jelly buckets there that we would dip into. You know, you could grab a cookie and dip it into a jelly bucket. And all of the things that you would probably cringe at today, seeing something like that happen, right. That was our world. So, I mean, it was, you know, the bakery was just one of those things. All of the people that were the employees at the bakery, they were really nice, and, you know, they kind of treated us like family. And my mom would talk about how when I was a baby, she would take me in, and when they didn't have daycare available and nobody could watch me, they would put me in the glazing bowl that wasn't being used, and I would sleep in there as a baby. So, I mean, it's like, you know, you do what you got to do. And I've had that same experience with my kids, you know, when they get suddenly there isn't school one day for whatever reason, or we don't have somebody to watch the kids or something like that, bring them to the bakery. And the first thing I do is throw an apron and a hat on them and take them over to the bench and say, let's make some cookies. And I just let them make their cookies, and they bake them and take them home and eat them. But it gives them something to do, and it gives them an exposure to the business. So that's pretty cool.
Chad, where was and when the first Eklof Bakery at?
So the first Eklof Bakery was on Foot Avenue, where Tasty Corners was located on that corner. And it was Tasty Corners, Eklof's, and I believe Rockman's Super Duper was just a small shopping area at the time. Then when they built the plaza, Rockman's and the bakery moved back into the plaza as one of the first businesses that were built. If you're looking at the plaza, the left half or the south half of the plaza, they were one of the first businesses, and Rockman's and Eklof's were right next to each other.
And are you the second generation, or does it go back three generations? Or
well, I'm the third generation at Eklof Bakery, fourth generation baker in America from my family. My great-grandfather, David Eklof, moved here from Sweden, and he worked in several bakeries between Warren and Jamestown. And then my grandfather also worked in the bakeries. And I, you know, I'm not 100% on the history, but one of them was running a bakery called the Scandia, which we believe was located somewhere near the Armory. I've had several people tell me different bits of information about where it was located. But that's kind of where I've sort of nailed down where I think it might have been, and I could be wrong. But there was the Scandia Bakery for a little while, and then that closed. Then my grandfather had gone off to, he was in the Navy, and when he came back from the service, that's when he opened Eklof Bakery in 1956. So my grandfather owned Eklof's. And then he passed away at a young age. My dad was still only a teenager. So my grandmother ran it for a little while, as long as she could. And then when I was about 4 years old, my dad bought the bakery from her. So that would have been around 1976, 77-ish. He bought the bakery from her. And then he ran it up until 2 years ago when I started running the business.
Is some of the product up there this afternoon, or this morning, excuse me, is that the same products that were available way back when?
Yes. As a matter of fact, if you were to take a tour of the back of the bakery, I would show you our recipe cards. We have these little boxes with index cards, and we have cards that are so fragile that you can barely, you know, handle them. and they would fall apart on you, just covered in grease and flour and all sorts of, but they're the original. We work off of the exact same formulas that were used when the bakery was opened in 1956. The only difference is the ingredients we get in now have changed, you know, in several different ways. So while there may be a different flavor profile to like our rye bread, we used to be able to get a special rye flavoring that we used that was a mixture of anise and caraway. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. So now we just use ground caraway as the flavoring. We also used to be able to get a really dark molasses that none of our distributors carries anymore, so we don't have that. We also used to get a rye syrup, which was a different form of molasses, and nobody will carry that anymore because there were only a few bakeries using it, and the distributors said, we're not selling enough of it, so you can't have it. Well,
the late Jim Roselli always had the question on this program and other places, in conversation, even on the sidewalk, he always wondered, who ate the first banana? I have a question. Where was the first donut made?
Oh, I have no idea. However, I have been told that, and I've read about it in history books, that donuts were a product of old sailing ships, that they were originally like an English tea cake, but they were made into a donut. And the reason why the donut has a hole in it is because the captain of the ship oftentimes would want tea and donuts while he was piloting the ship. The ships had big giant wheels with spokes on them. Well, you're piloting the ship. There's nowhere to put your donuts. Oh, so the cook on board the ship came up with the idea of punching a hole in the donut before frying it so the captain could put them on the spokes of the steering wheel. And then that's how he would maintain his donuts while he was piloting the
it's
ship.
It's a fantastic story.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as I know, that there's truth to it. I've read about it several times.
Sure. When I want to get a good life with a gang sometime, can I use that story?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yep.
So Chad Eklof from Eklof's Bakery, I mean, you're not just, you know, a bakery guy. Like I was saying off the air, there's so many different ways and directions we can go. I guess, can we go back to before you had the responsibility of working in the bakery? Mm-hmm. Childhood. I mean, other than being at the bakery, what did Chad Eklof do for fun as a kid? Did you get in trouble?
I didn't get in that much trouble. I was the one kid that followed the directions, I guess, more or less, and was afraid to get in trouble. I didn't like the idea of getting in trouble. So I didn't do a whole lot of stuff that got me in trouble. I grew up in the Allen Park area, right over by Rogers School. So we went to Allen Park a lot and did things. Friends and I played baseball. I played Little League baseball. My dad coached my city rec team. And he coached my Little League team. And I did Little League for a while. And then I kind of drifted away from the school-type sports. I ended up in karate. So I toured around the country with the old karate school that used to be up here on Fairmont Avenue that now just recently got taken out.
Right.
Yeah, which was probably to most people's pleasure.
Right.
But I was a member of that school for the longest time, and I competed nationwide doing that. At one point in time, I was ranked 8th. In the tri-state area, Pennsylvania, Ohio, New York. Really? So that was something that I did that was really interesting and fun and kept me going. I did a lot of alone time in my bedroom because I didn't go out and do too much. I had friends, but, you know, we didn't do a whole lot. So I did a lot of alone time, which caused me to take up different things. I tried juggling for a while. I did that until I knocked myself a few times in the head too many. And then once I got a few bumps in the head from the juggling, I took up magic. So I started as a teenager playing around with the magic stuff. And that led me to meet people through the magic parlor that was on Fairmount Avenue in the old Allen Steakhouse building. Do you remember the Allen Steakhouse?
Yeah.
Okay, the magic parlor was there for a while. That's where I got introduced to the guys who were local that were doing magic. They led me to the two different rings, the people that were out of Buffalo, and I wandered into Maplehurst Country Club to watch a magic show where I met a dear friend of mine, Wally Holmes, and he and I bonded. I mean, he was fantastic for me. So I met Wally. I was the bartender doing magic up at Maplehurst for a while. Through that group of people that were performing up at Maplehurst, I was introduced to some world-famous magicians who were part of the International Brotherhood of Magicians Ring Number 2, the very second ring that was established in this country out of Youngstown, Ohio. So I got a chance to meet some legendary magicians there. I did the magic stuff. I used to be a bowler. I went into the Navy. While I was in the Navy, I took back up into magic, and I actually found one of the idols that I had from books and videos that I learned magic from. I located him in San Diego. I created a fantastic bond with him, and through him, I was introduced to the Magic Parlor in Hollywood, the Magic Castle in Hollywood, California. And through the castle, I met more legendary magicians and stuff. So, I mean, it's like I went further into that world than I ever thought I would. All while I was in the Navy. So the magic actually took me around the world, and I would carry my stuff with me on the ship. And there was one time we pulled into a port in Australia, Albany, Australia. Albany was the first port. Melbourne, Australia was where we pulled in. And at that second port in Melbourne, I had gotten a hold of, I looked in the back of my IBM magazine, the International Brotherhood of Magicians, for all of the rings around the world.
Yeah.
And I found one in Melbourne. So I got a hold of a guy, his name was David Wright. And I wrote to him through email from the contact information in the book that I got. And he ended up meeting my ship on the pier. And he took me for a tour of Melbourne while everybody else was out doing the casinos and the bars and all that. I was touring the ocean side and enjoying shark and chips and getting to see the countryside like I never thought I would. There was one port in the Albany port I talked about. A little story. I don't know if we have time before
just
break.
A few. No, go ahead.
But there's a story I like to tell. When I was in Albany, Australia, I only had $50 in my pocket, and these guys wanted to go out and enjoy themselves at one of the nightclubs in the area. And they're like, dude, you got to come with. And I just couldn't spend the money. I didn't have the money to spend. And I told them, I said, oh, I'm kind of down. They're like, dude, you got to come out with us. You got to come out to this. We've heard all about this place. It's great. I said, all right, I'll tell you what. Let me get a deck of cards and we'll go out. So we went out to the bar. I took the deck of cards with me and I asked one of my buddies to buy me a Pepsi in a rocks glass with a bunch of ice in it. I said, if you just get me a Pepsi, that's all I need. So as the evening went on, I sipped on the Pepsi a little bit. And then when the right people came along, I started, hey, would you like to see something interesting? And I started doing these tricks. I started out with a vanishing cigarette trick, and it led to card tricks. And then they started inviting their friends over. And then while I'm doing tricks for them, the people are going, oh my God, you're so wonderful. Can I buy you your next drink? What are you drinking? And I'm like, oh, it's just a rum and Coke. And so then the rum and Coke started, and I walked away that night completely obliterated, having a good time. But the very first person that I performed for, that I did the vanishing cigarette trick for, was an editor for the local newspaper. And so as I was leaving that night, she invited me to the newspaper building, and I went there the next morning, and they ended up doing a feature on me in the local newspaper, which I have a copy of at home, with a picture of me with a fan of cards and a story about the ship that pulled in and the sailors entertaining the community and this and that. So, I mean, it's like just things just happen, and it's a lot of fun.
All of that, Russ, and all I asked was what I was like as a child.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the Navy. What brought you to decide in your life that you wanted to be a military man?
Well, my grandfather was in the military. My dad was in the military. And I always had it in the back of my mind that I thought that would be something I would like to do. And I kind of had it as a decision that was, if things aren't going the way I want them to go right now, I'm going to just run off and join the military. Mm. And so I was having some rough times, and I had a lot going on. I had a lot of things that were bugging me and a lot of things that were not feeling like they were going right. And I had happened to through bowling. I was bowling with the local recruiters, and I had happened to get into a conversation with them, and they were Navy recruiters, and right away they started with travel the world, see the world, you can do this, you can do that. It's the most wonderful thing. And I was like, I'll go take the test. All right, take me up there. I'll take the test. Let's see what happens. So I went up to Buffalo. I took the ASVAB test. I passed it. They brought me into a room and said, you did so well on the test that we'd like to offer you a position in the nuclear field. And I was like, that sounds like an awful lot of responsibility. So they said, well, what could we do to put you in to the Navy today? And I said, I don't know. Maybe if I worked on computers on submarines, that would be kind of cool. And so the guy says, I can do that for you. And so he takes me into another room. They do all this paperwork stuff. They funnel me into another room where they make me raise my hand and take an oath. They take me back into the other room and say, you're going to get exactly what you asked for. Congratulations. Welcome to the Navy. And I went home, and my dad and my mom and dad said, how'd you do on the test? I said, well, I'm going into the Navy. And so that was that, right? It was a whirlwind situation. Only to find out once I got in the Navy, there was no submarines in my orders. The computer thing was a sketchy idea because they signed me up as an electronics technician, which is the guys who work on radar, navigation systems, all of the different electronic systems. You're basically the electronic fix-it guy. And, you know, I fought for the first year and a half to try to get that submarine duty, and it just never came through because they kept pushing me from one school to the next, saying, you can take care of it at the next school. You can take care of it at the next school. And then the last school I went to, they said, when you get to the ship, talk to the guy at the ship, and they'll get you where you need to go, only to find out that was probably the biggest load of garbage they ever fed me. And then when I was in Bahrain, our ship pulled into a pier, and across the pier from us was the USS Jacksonville, and it was a fast attack submarine. And they were giving the sailors on our ship a tour of the submarine. So I went for the tour on the submarine, and I found out real quickly why I'm glad I never got on submarines. And I'll demonstrate. I had to walk through the submarine like this. So picture me walking with my head bent down, half bent over, because there was no way I would have ever fit inside that submarine and been and living comfortable. Not to mention those submarine guys, they hot rack.
Yeah.
You have 12 hours on, 12 hours off, and there's half as many beds as there are crew members. So during the 12 hours that you're there working, the other guy who's assigned to your rack is sleeping in the bed. And then when he gets up, he goes to work and you go to bed in the same bed, which is why they call it hot racking, because it never gets cold. So that also was a good reason why I'm glad I never went subsurface.
Something you continue to do, and I don't know, did you learn this from your family, or is it just something you know is supposed to be done, supporting other businesses and supporting the local community? Because you, not just as Eklofs, but as an individual, I know, are very much a big cheerleader for other businesses.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, well, it only makes sense. You can't have a community unless you have a productive community, which means all of your local businesses have to be running intact and doing a very good job. And so, like, just taking the bakeries, for example, from the time I was young, we always had a relationship with Jones Bakery. People, our customers will come in and go, Jones is better, this is better, that. And, you know, there's always that, you know, we think that we should prefer one over the other and this and that. But behind the scenes, I used to run up to Jones's all the time to pick up bags of ingredients if we ran short, and vice versa. If they ran short, they called. Today, I have a working relationship with Willie over at Farm Fresh, and we swap ingredients every now and then when we run low on stuff. Matter of fact, just not too long ago, our donut fryer broke down.
Right.
And we had a wedding cake that had donuts incorporated in the wedding cake. The donuts were part of the wedding cake, and we weren't going to be able to fry those donuts. And then they had another like 20 dozen donuts to go along with it. And that was a very big order that we took months and months in advance. And for me to call the customer and tell them that, hey, this weekend, I can't do your wedding cake. You know how hard it is to schedule? So I called Willie over at Farm Fresh. And Willie says, Chad, don't worry about it. We'll fry the donuts for you. You come pick them up, no problem. And so that's the kind of relationship that I have with other businesses, and I would do that in a heartbeat for anybody. I mean, to me, it makes perfect sense to have every business in the community running as strong as it possibly can, because it only benefits the community more to have that happening.
And can you get most of the basic products you need locally?
Not locally, I can't. You mean for the bakery?
Yeah.
The basic products, they come from either Pittsburgh, Erie, or Buffalo is where we can get the majority of all of the things that we need. So they're localized in the sense that we're getting them very close. We're not getting anything, you know, nationwide or cross-country or anything like that. But yeah, we do get what we need, although it's getting harder and harder. There's been weeks now in the past few months where we've been told by our distributor, hey, the truck's coming in tomorrow, but there's no sugar on it. Now, how can you run a bakery without sugar?
Right.
And so, I mean, then we have to scramble and try to find, and we've had stuff freighted up from Pittsburgh. So we end up paying a high cost of freight and shipping in order to get something up overnight. I mean, it's a hard thing to do right now. Nothing is running the way it's supposed to at this point in time, but you know, we make do.
Well, as I opened the show, I made a point about how you know, during this pandemic, being a supporter and kind of a big cheerleader for local business. One thing I think you probably do better than almost any other business in town that I can think of is communication with your clients.
Mm-hmm.
And you have found that, social media, Facebook, I mean,
right.
you say, hey, we have an issue with our donut machine or we're low on sugar. I mean, you've told your customers that. I mean, it's not a secret of how almost you run the bakery.
Right. Yeah. No, I've found that helps out a lot. You know, the customers are forgiving as long as they're not blindsided and hit from the back with stuff. So the one thing I hate is I hate having a customer walk in and they're like, why do you not have this? Why have you not had this? And we just go, oh, whatever. We got this other stuff by that. I prefer to tell them I'm not getting the ingredient right now. And I give them a heads up so they know not to come. And, you know, people will say, well, that's kind of crazy because you're basically telling customers not to shop with you this week. Well, that's true, but I'm also asking them not to waste their time too,
right,
which they appreciate. And then as soon as I get back on the Facebook and say, we've got it, mm-hmm, I got a line out the door. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's, you know, it works in my favor. The social media thing is, it's one of those tricky things. I hate social media.
Yeah.
I don't want anything to do with it. I hate it. The only reason I have a social media account is because of the bakery.
Yeah.
And social media has caused the bakery some problems too. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who just like to sit at home and do what they do mm-hmm best on social media. That being said, I try to take everything with a grain of salt, but I also try not to let people get the best of me. Mm-hmm. So I'd go on there and I'm just me. I'm a genuine guy. And I have people who come in all the time. This summer, I had a ton of people coming in from all over now that they can travel again.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming in from all, they're like, oh, we had to come in and shop because we so-and-so got us hooked on these videos that you make online. And we just wanted to meet the baker that does these funny videos. Because I've done some hilarious videos. Oh, yeah. I've done some serious ones, but sure, I have a lot of fun with it.
What are those items from Eklof's Bakery over the years that people will stand outside to get?
Well, right now it's the cider fry cakes, and I brought you guys some cider fry cakes.
This is why I invite him up here, Russ.
Yeah.
He always brings something.
Yeah, I brought you guys some cider fry cakes to enjoy. But the cider fry cakes are out right now. In the beginning of the year, it's the punchki donut.
Mm-hmm.
And we break the rules. The punchki is supposed to be made on Fat Tuesday only. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people follow that rule. I choose not to. We start making punchkis about the second week of January because what happens is on January 1st, everybody makes a resolution and they say, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to eat healthy. I'm going to be healthy. And then it's about 2 weeks that it takes me to break those resolutions because if I can't get them with a punchki, it's only a couple weeks later and I've got them with chocolate stuff for Valentine's Day. So, you know, I'm sorry. I got to apologize to everybody for all those broken resolutions out there, but I know you're all happier for it.
The one thing I've written down, I knew we were going to talk about is the famous pink stripe cookie.
Sure.
So for the audience out there from Chad Eklof directly, tell us the story, because it's a fascinating story.
Okay.
Of the pink striped cookie.
Yep. So when the bakery was open in 1956, there was a guy wandering around. I don't know that this was his name, but it's the name on the machine. It's Arjax Mölndal. And I don't even know that I say it correctly. But he was going around peddling this spritz gun that he had invented. At the time, people were using a handheld tube that they would load the cookie dough into and then crank from the backside as they walked down the table, and it would crank out spritz through a die. So he invented one that was on these wooden rollers so that you could load it up and just roll it down the bench. He was peddling them to the local bakeries. I don't know. And again, I get there's a lot of people who come into the bakery and want so badly to tell me that we weren't the first ones doing it. And that's fine. I'm sure there may have been another bakery in town doing it. But as far as I know, the only place that you could get them was Eklof's. I've heard Edborg or Hedberg's. So, you know, it could be, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But anyways, he was peddling this cookie gun. And so my grandfather bought one and they were making cookies with it. Well, at the same time that they started opening up the bakery, he noticed that, or as I'm told, he noticed that people were standing out in the front of the store with kids. At the time, you know, grandmas and moms would take the kids around, dad would be working, and the kids would be getting a little rambunctious out in the front of the store. So he told the staff at the bakery, you know, give the kids a cookie. Give the kids a cookie to give them something to do so that way they can shop and it doesn't cause problems. So the staff had decided that the one with the pink stripe would be a good cookie to give away. So they started handing these cookies out for free to the kids every time they walked through the door. So that became the stat, you know, that was what we did. They handed out the free pink stripe cookies. And now, because like, you know, over the generations of people going in there as kids getting pink stripe, now they bring their kids in for the sole purpose of that experience, getting a pink stripe cookie. I tried to sit down and figure out just using a general idea of the amount of kids that we see on a day-to-day basis coming in that we hand out free cookies to. And I believe that there has been somewhere over 2 million cookies handed out for free out of the front of the bakery since 1956. And it still continues today. And, you know, pretty soon I'm going to be launching a Pink Stripe Cookie Club. And the Pink Stripe Cookie Club, I've got these little pink, you've seen them rubber bracelets people wear. And it says official Pink Stripe Cookie Club member. And then on the other side, it says happiness begins with a stripe. And people who are the pink, because what I get is I get a lot of adults come in and say, so am I too old to get a Pink Stripe cookie now? So anybody who's a member of the Pink Stripe Cookie Club, the adults who are wearing this bracelet will get a free Pink Stripe cookie when they walk in the door. And kids will get two instead of one.
Oh.
So, I mean, it's, you know, I like to keep playing on it, but it's the most popular item we have. I make anywhere from, on a slow day, we'll do 48 dozen of them. But typically every day I do at least 96 dozen of those cookies we make. And on our busy days, we'll do 192 dozen. And we make them every single day.
What's the biggest wedding cake you guys have done?
I think the tallest cake that we would be able to do, just going off of the layers that we have, would be like a 5-layer cake. And it would be separated tiers, so you would have the columns between the tiers. So that would get you about 5 foot tall, almost 6 foot tall. And, you know, that was back in the day, that was a wedding cake. That was a wedding cake. You had the big tall cakes with the fountain in the middle. You had stairs coming off the cake onto mm-hmm. satellite cakes. I mean, that was a big deal. Now the cakes are small. People, they want cupcakes more than they do cakes.
When you're
now
watching these TV shows, do you watch these TV shows of all these bakers and decorate? I mean, do you watch this? Is it like a professional? You just, it's a burnout factor. You try not to.
I don't watch them.
You don't watch them.
I don't watch them. I'm done when I go home. I'm done. I'm not going to watch it on TV all day. I stare at it all morning. But I do know of the shows. I mean, I peek at them every now and then to see what kind of stuff they're doing. And the only reason I do is because that's what people are watching when they come right in and they want stuff. And yeah, it's tough. It's tough because, like, the fondant thing that you see on TV, it tastes terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it tastes terrible. There's some fondants out there that are palatable at best, but they're terrible. And most of the time what they do is when they have them beautiful fondant cakes, that goes into the kitchen when it's ready to serve to the guests and they rip the fondant off because they know nobody's going to like it. And so they get cake with like no icing on it because the fondant took half the icing off when they ripped it off. So, but the people will come in and they'll want these things that they've seen on TV and they don't realize that the Food Network is paying those people to do those. And those bakers, they hire sculptors, mm-hmm. they hire artists, they hire, you know, I mean, they have staffs of people who in different artistic genres to make those cakes happen. It's not just one person. Now, there's people in town here that are doing some really neat cakes. I've seen a lot of really neat cakes that people have been doing in town. We just don't do them because we have such a high volume of other stuff to do
right.
that if I have to pull a cake decorator aside and work on one of these fantastic cakes like they see on TV, I'd have to charge for two people to be spending all of their time on that cake, and the amount that that cake would cost is just out of people's budget. Mm. I mean, people come in and they want a simple cake, and when I tell them just from the cost of ingredients and the time that it takes to make it as it is, and I quote them a couple $100s for a cake, they look at me like I got monkeys flying out of my eyes. Mm. And so, I mean, it's a difficult business to be in, servicing weddings, that's for sure.
We're having a little technical issue with Russ's microphone. I'll get that resolved. But Russ asks the question, how many different varieties of bread are there?
Oh, there's a ton of varieties of bread. Yeah, I mean, we make like four, but there's a ton of varieties out there. Once you get into all the different grains and the different sourdoughs and things like that, we do a white bread, a rye bread, a wheat bread, and then we do like our version of an Italian-style Vienna bread. And those are the breads that we do on a regular basis. And then that, you know, we also do like hamburger hot dog buns, butter bits, you know, those kinds of rolls. Mm-hmm. But those are the breads that we stick to, and we stick to what we know our customers like.
Now, how do you make a sourdough?
Well, a sourdough is fun. I actually tried one during this pandemic thing. I put it together. I went beyond try. It was a delicious bread. I made three different versions of sourdough. But with sourdough, the idea is you're capturing wild yeast. So what you do is you take some flour and you take some water, and you mix it together and make this paste, a loose paste, a really wet paste. And you set it on your counter and you just leave it. And what happens is there's yeast in the air everywhere. There's yeast in this room. It's just a part of nature. It's one of the biological cells that's floating around everywhere. And so yeast will feed off of anything that has a sugar product in it, which sugar is in wheat flour, corn flour, things like that. So if you let it sit there and it starts to ferment and get funky, you've captured yeast. So now what you do is you keep feeding it. So you take half of it out and you put water and flour in. Let it sit for a couple of days. You'll see it start to bubble and rise and get funky looking again. Starts to let off an aroma. And you take half of it out and you put water and flour in. You do this for about 2 weeks and you're going to have a stable yeast that they would use, or a stable starter for your sourdough. Now you can take that little batch of goo that you've made and you can add it to a bread recipe instead of using commercial yeast. So you can add your starter, and the starter has enough natural yeast is much stronger than commercial. Mm-hmm. So you have this natural yeast just in there ready to feed. And if you give it the right environment, and it's a long process, it doesn't work rapidly. But if you let your dough sit overnight or for 2 days in some cases, your dough will rise to the point that you can bake it. And then when you bake it, you have, because of the slow nature of the maturity of the yeast in the bread, it gives off this not so pungent flavor, but it gives off this different characteristic flavor that makes that sourdough unique. And that's why San Francisco sourdough is so unique, because the yeast out there produces a unique flavor, and they've been harvesting that yeast out there for a long time. But I did it. I was making sourdough. We just weren't selling enough of it, and the time-consuming nature behind it and all the process of feeding it and feeding it, it's very expensive to do. I just couldn't work it into our regular routine.
You need a doctorate to be a baker. Because of all the
it's science. Baking is science. It's all science. Yeah.
Now, I want to go back to the computers, because
sure.
I know, like you said, I don't watch that. Bakery's done. My day's done.
Yep.
You know? So one thing I know you've had an interest in is, you know, technology and
sure.
computers in general.
Mm-hmm.
At one point getting the moniker Chad the Computer Guy.
That's right. Right here.
Here at the radio station. So
computers. I mean, something that's just always been fascinating to you?
Yes. When I was a kid, I would have told you while I was still in school that I was going to grow up to build robots and be a robot engineer. That's what I wanted to do. I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. I wanted to write software, all of that. Naturally, I got into that electronics world in the Navy, so that got me a big kickstart into understanding and knowing all of the electronics that go into the items. But just the idea of the computer, it's a puzzle that most people want to kick out their window. And to me, it just makes me want to solve it. So you learn through all of the little bugs and problems that go on with it. You start to learn more about how they work. You learn more about the ins and outs of how they work. And you start to kind of get a mind for it. And once you've got that mind for it, it just stays. I mean, you just, I love it. I love tinkering with computers and electronic gadgets and things like that. To me, like I said, they're a great where you might be able to not send an email and you're like, ah, I can't get this stupid email to go out. We got to call the IT guy. Well, the IT guy is like me. He's like, ooh, I'm going to find that problem because I know what that might be. So, I mean, yeah, to me, that's the thrill in it, is just the inner workings of the computer just make me, just gets exciting. Yeah.
They say now the day is coming that the robots are going to build the robots.
Oh, eventually they will. Yeah. I mean, they already do. You already have robots building other products and stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, that's been going on for the longest time in the auto industry. It's just they're not aware of what they're doing. Nowadays, they keep talking about the artificial intelligence and computers becoming more or less aware. And if you look at what they're, a car driving itself has to be aware of something, has to be aware of its surroundings, and it has to be able to make decisions based on what it determines is going on.
Can you talk to a robot? You have a robot here. Can you tell him, go over there in the corner and pick up that ball?
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to because you got to write a whole program
to
tell it to do that. It's possible. There's robots out there you can do that. My kids have a little R2-D2 robot that you can tell to play games and to play hide and seek. You can go hide in the room and it'll run around the room and look for you. And if it finds you, it makes a bunch of whistling noises and stuff. So they have the capability of doing that through voice commands. But, you know, it's only following instructions that have been hard-coded into it and reacting to what you're telling it to do based on those instructions.
Yeah.
That whole artificial intelligence thing that they talk about with social media and that stuff, that's the scary stuff. Because
can a robot make those cookies?
Well, a robot could, but it wouldn't enjoy them on break like I do, you see? So that's the difference between us.
A robot can't taste test the product.
That's right.
That's another Chatikloff, another thing I know and I wanted to talk to you about was photography.
Mm-hmm.
This is another thing that I don't think a lot of people are as familiar if they know of the Eklof brand, if you will, and you is.
Sure.
This is something that you have done and I can personally say are fantastic at it, and I'm sure would like to do more of it, but this is a whole other.
Yeah.
People make a living off of doing this as well.
Sure.
And it's just a little hobby you get to do sometimes.
Yeah, it's a hobby. And it started from the radio show that I was doing here. I was doing the blue screen radio show, doing the computer and technology stuff. And a friend of mine, John Fuchs, came on the show and he was talking about photography. And I had brought him onto the show to talk about, you know, what's the difference between digital photography and analog photography, the old style cameras. And he started talking digital photography. We got into the topic of file storage and media storage and what to do with these digital files once they get into your computer, which stemmed a whole bunch of shows that I did with him side by side with me. And we tried to explain things. I got invited down to the Audubon, and there's the Audubon photo club that they have down there. They invited me in to talk about digital media storage and different file types and why one file type would work better than another. And in doing that, they said, bring your camera and bring a picture. So I brought a picture that I took. And from there, I met some friends and they started getting me into all of that photography world. And from that photography world, I bought my first camera. my first good camera. Any camera is a good camera, but I bought, at the time I was like, ooh, I'm going to step up to a good camera. So I bought my first camera and I had a lot of guidance and made a lot of friends and we went on trips and did stuff. And I was taking pictures of birds and I was taking pictures of landscapes. And then I was doing art gallery shows at the Prendergast. And then all of a sudden I took my son to the very first Southern Tier Express hockey game. And when I did that, I brought my camera and I'm like, I'm going to try to take pictures of the guys on the ice. And there was the same thing that happens with computers. The pictures didn't come out. And I'm like, why can't I get a picture of these hockey players? I did not know that hockey was the hardest sport to shoot. I did not know that there are certain limitations that your camera can do. So to me, it became a puzzle I had to solve. And I started shooting the hockey players. And in doing so, the hockey players got excited over the pictures. I shared some with the Post Journal. Scott Kinberg and the guys over at the Post Journal called me and said, hey, how would you like to? And it turned into me writing articles in the paper about photography, just little tips and things that I've learned along the way about photography, and side job, shooting sports photos for the newspaper. So I did the sports photos for the newspaper for a few years. And because I was hovering around on the sidelines shooting sports photos, naturally I started getting jobs shooting sports teams. And so now that's my side gig. I have a little business that I run and I do sports photography. So now I'm not shooting so much birds and stuff, but since the pandemic, when sports shut down, all of that went away. I stopped getting calls from the Post Journal. I stopped getting calls from sports teams. And just now, I've just now started getting some calls from teams. So I just shot Maple Grove soccer teams the other few weeks ago, both the boys and girls soccer teams. And I'm the guy that prints the big 12-foot by 5-foot team banner that they hang on the field, and then big 3-foot by 4-foot banners that they hang up for senior night every year at Maple Grove for the soccer teams.
What's the mechanical or whatever the scientific difference between taking a picture of a football player in action than a hockey player in action?
The biggest thing is lighting. So your camera needs light in order to take a picture. So when you have your camera and you're taking a picture, you set your camera to get the optimal photo. And all you're doing is telling the camera how to capture the light that's around you. So you have three different ways of capturing it. You have your aperture, which means how big or small the opening is in the lens. You have the time that that aperture is open, which is your shutter speed. And then you have what they call now in the digital world, ISO speed, which is how sensitive your sensor is to the light that's coming in. And those three things make up your triangle that you work with to get a camera to take a good picture. Football is either played during the day outside or during the nighttime with bright light shining down on the field. So you have lights available that are compensating for the lack of light in the sky. They're lighting the players up so you can set your camera a little bit lower and take the pictures and get the shot. Whereas hockey is played in an arena with crappy lighting, unless you're shooting pro sports. Mm-hmm. But if you're shooting a local arena, the lighting is at best half of what you would light a room with. It just seems bright enough because the white ice is reflecting some of that light. So that's the other factor with hockey that you have, is you have reflected light coming from the bottom of the arena as opposed to light coming from the top. So you're dealing with two different kinds of light shooting onto your players. And then they're skating 70 miles an hour down the ice, and you're trying to capture the shot that has the puck that's being flung 200 miles an hour at a net. And you want to see that shot where the puck is right in front of the goalie. The goaltender is like, whoa, the guy's got the stick pointing right at him. And you got that little glimmer of light coming off that skate blade that goes zing. Yeah. And that's the money shot right there. So it's a lot goes into shooting hockey.
But can't they doctor up a lot of photographs? Can't they take a picture of the puck and a picture of the hockey player and a picture of the stick and kind of get it all put together?
You can. I could do that if I was shooting for the hockey teams for their portraits and things like that. Mm-hmm. I've done that several times where I've put things in that aren't really there. I've done that for the sake of shooting portraits. But when you're shooting for sports journalism, you have to shoot a real photo. You can't do anything at all to the picture. You just have to capture that natural time.
I think I read a while back, quite a while back, that photography the photographs were not desirable or legal in a trial, in a court, because they can be doctored up.
Mm. Yes.
And this program today is not in Jamestown. This is a where are we? Yeah, we're on an iceberg someplace.
Yeah, I know.
And then you can dog
a lot of deep fakes now.
Yeah.
With everything, not just pictures, but audio. I mean,
there's a commercial on TV that shows a girl who represents hunger across the nation, and it says right on there, she says, "I was created by artificial intelligence from the faces of thousands of hungry."
So I just saw that this weekend. Maybe during a football game or something.
Yeah, and that's what it is. Is it's a computer generated person.
Wow.
That
wow.
they created from samplings of thousands and thousands of impoverished people's faces, and they came up with what they believe is the face of hunger.
How far is this technology going to go?
Oh, it's going to go beyond what we care to go. That's for sure.
Yeah, there will be a breaking point where something's going
to
happen.
That's why I like to hang out in the woods.
We have a few more minutes left here with Chad Eklof, our guest on WJTN and the Times of Your Life. One thing we have not got into, Chad, and you've brought this up a few times, but fatherhood.
Sure.
I want to talk about Chad Eklof, the dad.
Okay.
Because you have some fantastic little Eklofs in your life.
Yeah. I've got three sons. They're now 16, 10, and 7.
Jeez.
So they'll be 11 and 8 within the next couple of weeks. They're a good time. I mean, we've had a lot of fun with the kids. I've gotten them into the sports. We did the hockey. We've done football. This year, Ethan started playing football, my youngest one, and we found his sport. I can tell you that right now. We found his sport. All his teammates, they all call him Wrecking Ball. He plays flag football, but boy, I'll tell you, this kid really represents out there. It's pretty wild to watch him. And, Jacob has done fantastic. He's been on two award-winning baseball teams. He does a fantastic job. Both of them did great in hockey. My oldest son, Isaac, he's tried out a couple of different sports. And, it's been a lot of fun. And just being there as a dad is the coolest thing. And, there's trials and tribulations, and everybody knows that once they get into the job. And you find out, you learn as you go, and you have fun with it and make the best out of it. But, yeah, we have a great time. When I was doing the radio show, I remember one of the times I had Isaac with me. He was, at the time, I think he was only like 4 or 5 years old. And I brought him in, and I thought, well, I got no choice. I was doing a live show. And I brought him in one Sunday morning when I was doing the show. And I sat him down, and he was tinkering around. And I thought, let me get him on the air and let him talk about the little video games that he plays. And I wish I had it queued up, because I have that show recorded. I have all of my shows recorded, which they're not interesting to anybody, I'm sure. But I have that show recorded, and he was on the microphone talking about his video games and stuff. And as I'm interviewing him about what he likes to play on his computer, he's like, "Dad?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "I just peed my pants." And I went, "Oh, well, that's wonderful." And so we keep on going with the interview. And I said, "Well, I'm going to go ahead and take a commercial break here. And when we come back, hopefully we've got that taken care of." And it was hilarious. It was absolutely hilarious, the things that come out of their mouths. And so whenever I couldn't make it to the radio station, that was the episode I queued up as a replay to fill the space if I couldn't make it to do a show. And I got so many emails from that episode where I had him on there. It was just fantastic.
How old is he today?
He's 16.
And we tell that story today?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what's it going to be like when you go home?
Oh, it's not a big deal. He knows. Okay. We play it every now and then at home just to laugh over it.
That's marvelous.
Oh, the kids are wonderful. They don't care. They have my sense of humor, so we're good.
Is there a baker in any of them?
Well, all three of Isaac. My oldest son, Isaac, he lives in Minnesota with his mom, so he comes here for the summer every year. And when he comes here for the summer, he works at the bakery with me. The last few years, he's gone in and worked the summers at the bakery. So he's done that. I don't know if that's the route he's going to go, but he's come in and worked, and he does a fantastic job. And then I've brought the other two in. Jacob and Ethan, they've both come in and worked at the bakery every now and then. I've woke them up at 4 a.m. and brought them with me so they can see what it's like. And as a matter of fact, I created a monster doing that, because I brought them in at 4 a.m. and me being funny dad, I'm like, "Now listen, first thing we got to do when we get to the bakery is get a cup of coffee. So let's go get a cup of coffee." So I gave them both a cup of coffee, and now my youngest one is a coffee fiend. He will try his hardest. He wakes up on Sunday morning if he hears me, and he comes out and he's like, "Dad, can we get coffee?" Oh, and so I'm like, "Well, you can't tell your mom." So when mom wakes up, she's like, "What are you drinking?" "Oh, hot chocolate." Hot chocolate is what. So, but he, yeah, I'll tell you, it's they like that kind of stuff.
Well, I know the weather's been warm this week, but the nights are still rather chilly, and sometimes there's nothing better than relaxing in your favorite chair with some Light Rock favorites on WJTN and your favorite beverage in your hand, and that's when Rainer's Liquor Store comes in. Rainer's on Fluvanna Avenue, one of the nicest places you'll enter. A huge variety of wine, spirits, and those trending products that are very popular locally and around the world. Rainer's has new deliveries coming in each week of the usual favorites, but also brings in new products from week to week that have been encouraged by their customers or they've come across on their travels around the country. They got the local wines, regional wines, of course, wines from all over the world. And Rainer's Liquors has the knowledge that will pair your drink with what's going to be served at that dinner. If you want to take it to a dinner party, you're not sure what to take, Rainer's can help you out. They have a lot of education and experience when it comes to feeding your large gathering with the celebration that needs champagne. Rainer's Liquor Store, the place to go. Stop and see Uncle Dave and Aunt Marilyn on Fluvanna Avenue. Thank them for sponsoring the times of your life on WJTN.
As we begin to wrap up the show here, Chad, I have to imagine, I mean, of all these different things, there's not many people. There's a few people in this town over the history of its years. You know, the Prendergasts, you know, are the names, or the Fentons and the Russ Dietrichs and the Roselli's. And then there's the name Eckloff.
Mm-hmm.
And what's it like? Have you ever really reflected on it and said, you know what? I'm pretty proud of this, the fact that I'm continuing this on, because it really is a name that means so much to so many different people.
Sure.
And not just holidays, but birthdays, celebrations for so long. I mean, that's cool.
Yeah, it is. It's cool. We've been a part of a lot of people's celebrations. You know, people know me from the name. They don't know me as a person, but they know me from the name. And I take that with great pride. To me, it's, you know, it's different than when I was a kid. When I was a kid, people knew the bakery and they knew the name and all that stuff, and it was kind of annoying. But as you get older, you start to appreciate the fact that you've been around in a sense as part of people's lives.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a neat responsibility to carry. I get a lot of people that come in and they'll order birthday cakes, and they're like, "Oh, you know, I got my birthday cakes were made here when I was little," and or "Your mom has made all of my kids' birthday cakes," and this and that. And, you know, when you hear things like that, it kind of takes it to a different level than just, it's not like, you know, I don't consider our name to be like superstar stuff. You know, I mean, we're just people running a bakery down in the south side of town. But it's kind of neat knowing that you've been a part of everybody's lives in a certain way. And so I kind of try my hardest to make sure that while I'm continuing the tradition at the bakery, that I'm making sure that people can get what they know and have always gotten from the business, because that's what the name is attached to. It's not attached to me or my dad or whatever. It's attached to the product that business has been putting out to the community. And so my way of representing the name is continuing that product, not necessarily carrying the name on my shoulder and being like, "I'm an Eckloff." So that's kind of the way I see it.
Where did the name Chad come from? Was it a family name?
No, I don't know where it came from. My mom probably thought some Chad guy was cool looking or something.
That's
I don't know. Well, I know for a fact that they wanted to carry a couple of family names, but they were already being used. So it kind of, there's like the Davids and the Erics, and my grandfather's name was Dick. My dad's name was Richard. My middle name is Richard. So, I mean, it's like there was names being reused, and I think my mom liked the name Chad, so she went with it.
Good.
Yep.
Well, at least you weren't named after a bakery item.
Oh, hey, that would have been interesting, huh? Fritter?
Yeah, I'm so. Yeah. I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow. Yeah. Fritter. Actually, it's a great name.
Fritter Eckloff. Oh man, maybe I'll work on a fourth get
there
that.
There you go. Yeah. Surprise.
The Eckloff I know is a flirter. I don't think he's a flirter.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, with that said, we are unfortunately out of time. But Chad, this ended up being everything I thought it was going to be.
Sure.
I mean, such a a lot to talk about with you. And hopefully, you know, for those that are listening to the show and coming to the bakery that don't know a little more about Chad, you're more than just the bakery in the back that makes, you know, wonderful tasting of foods. There's, you know, there's the man, the myth, the legend of Chad.
Something like that. The guy who is a jack of many trades, master of none, and wears so many hats that his head hurts.
There you go.
That's it.
Well, Chad Eklof, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you, Chad.
Russ, awesome show as always.
It sure is.
And I'll tell you what, we have a list of people we're going to be interviewing over the next few weeks here, and what a list we have.
You have been busy.
I have some fascinating people in store. This show and all shows available at our website, WJTN.com. Big thank you to our sponsors, including the folks at Rainer's Liquor Store and Lena's Pizza. In upcoming shows, we're going to feature Kimberly Lombard, Tom Schmidt, the Tirana family. John Elder is going to be here. Clyde Card, Frank Larisella. We're going to try to get on with some Tom Fisher, David Troxell, maybe even Noel Blackhall, a former voice and name here on the radio show. So keep listening every week. And as always, we appreciate you for joining us here on WJTN and the times of your life.
And it's a good day, it's a good time to be a Bills fan. And there's no better way to enjoy the game than with Lena's Pizza for your watch parties. Lena's is a staple in the Jamestown community, and they've got a great reputation. Why? Because they use the freshest, never-frozen ingredients for your pizza pies. Traditional pizzas, specialty pizzas, chicken fingers, those delicious, juicy, jumbo chicken wings that come in a variety of flavors. Lena's is truly a routine in the lives of people here in Jamestown and those that have moved away and come back to visit. Now, it's not unheard of for a family to order a couple of these pizzas, freeze them, and then travel back to their houses across the country so when they get there, they can enjoy that taste of home. Lena's has that secret family recipe for their sauces. You will not experience that anywhere else. Lena's Pizza is online, so you can see their menu, but you can stop in anytime at 902 East 2nd Street in Jamestown. If you know what you like already, call Lena's 716-484-0600. And when you pick up your food, be sure to thank them for sponsoring the times of your life on WJTN.